Here we go. All right. So, what were you talking about before we started?
Okay. So, I was thinking about, have you heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
The Dunning-Kruger effect. No.
So, it's that the less you know about a topic, the more of an expert you think you are.
Okay.
So, it's the it's the opposite of imposter syndrome, where, like, the more of an expert you are, the less you feel like you actually know about what you're talking.
Okay, no, this is not familiar to me.
So, Dunning-Kruger is the opposite of that. So, it's like where people are really, really sure that they're positive and have the answers about something, the less educated you are about that topic, the more likely you are to think you're an expert in it.
Why? That seems counterintuitive.
It's a little bit weird, yeah. But, so, it's that opposite end of being an expert makes you know how much you don't actually know about it. So you feel kind of insecure in your knowledge. But I was wondering, do you think that, like, YouTube or half of, like, the Instagram fitness things would exist if that effect wasn't true? Like, how many people are out there saying, I have the number one workout program for your body type, but they really just don't know anything at all, and they're just so sure about their method because they just don't know anything else? Like, I don't think that, like, any, like, YouTube channels could exist without this, like, I'm an expert for sure. I've watched a few other YouTube videos.
Yeah. I think, well, number one, I think that's definitely a thing. I think that people do kind of portray themselves as experts when really they don't have any either legit evidence of the contrary, or it's just like they'll something worked for them one time, so then it's like, oh, this is gonna work for everybody, and so they just, like, preach it, and they're trying to sell it, their solution, because it worked for them, and by, you know, because it worked for them, they're passionate about it, or they're excited about it, or they think that, you know, everybody should do it this way. And it's not necessarily the case, but those are the people that, like, are high in confidence but low in skill.
Yep.
It's just like...
It's exactly that problem. It's just like, ooh. And this is every commenter on every YouTube video or weightlifting Instagram post. Like, did you see... Kate and I put it up in her story, but somebody was sending her messages like, hey, can you really call yourself an athlete? Because no one's trying to stop you from lifting the weights. And she got into this huge argument with this guy and put it up on her Instagram. It was pretty funny to read through.
Okay.
It might be gone now because it was a story. Yeah, but yeah. He was essentially saying, like, well, weightlifters and swimmers and runners aren't really athletes because they aren't, like, if they went up against a football player in a test of strength, they would fail horribly. And it's just like, that guy was so sure that he knew what the definition of athlete was.
Right, yeah.
And he was telling her stuff like, you don't look muscular enough to be 71 kilos. And, like, all kinds of weird stuff, man. So I think that, you know, that's part of the poison of the comments section.
Well, I think...
is that everyone who comments, like... how many times have you seen a video of, like, a professional lifter and some guy in the comments is like, that's going to hurt your knees.
Oh, you shouldn't squat that low. Or it's just, okay, so in today's world, if you want to prepare your kids for life, you put pictures up of their stuff on the refrigerator and then just put mean comments underneath it. And that'll help them get used to being on the internet. It's just like...
I mean, if you're not relentlessly critiquing your toddlers, I mean, let's get on board.
It's like, there's no such thing as a green sun, son. It doesn't work like that.
All right, but what is this? We got episode
30.
30?
Yeah, this is 30, because we did a mini-sode, and I don't really count that as an episode, so...
All right, well, so episode probably, 30.
Yeah, episode
Welcome
30.
Welcome back, everybody.
Hey, y'all. Mundo here, and once again, joined with Grayson. And so we sent out a poll to ask a couple questions for the podcast, and we didn't really get that much responses either because y'all are super lazy or nobody really listens.
We'll also do it a week earlier.
Oh, that's true. Next time. Yeah, that's probably...
But we got a couple of things we can go over.
Yeah, yeah.
I think probably the one of the better questions we got, and we can start with this one first, is why do kilograms weigh less than pounds? And I think that... there's a really, really obvious answer to this question. It's just because there's less of them.
Yeah.
there's only 80 kilos, but there's 176 pounds. It's a lower number. Of course it's going to be lighter, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I guess. If you think about it in that term, that way. But I don't know. I think kilograms do weigh more than pounds, though, for some reason.
So you can tell that we've got some really thoughtful questions to address on the show today. We'll knock out our second, our runner-up question, which is, why is Tyler Sanchez your favorite lifter?
And I think we decided that he's our favorite lifter because he requires a step stool to get to the cabinets in his kitchen.
Yes. So that's what makes him the favorite. Okay, so let's get into the couple of real questions we got here. What do you think is important about youth weightlifting? Like, what do you think's like a good reason for youth to get involved in the sport? Was the question asked, and I think that there's a couple of obvious benefits. Like, you know, if you're training at that age, you're improving bone density and setting up kind of healthy lifestyle habits young. So if you kind of get in the groove of the gym is kind of part of your weekly routine young, that kind of helps lay a groundwork going forward. I think that's probably a pretty good way of, like, the first priority is just making sure that you're kind of setting yourself up and setting your kids up for, you know, having some sort of, like, active lifestyle be a part of their week, you know. It gets kids, you know, up and moving when they're not, you know, just in their PE classes. But I think that, you know, a lot of times kids are playing other sports, and, you know, being strong in the weight room is definitely a good way to kind of help yourself be a little bit more adept at prevent injury, that sort of thing. But most importantly, I think that, you know, I think the reason I wish I had started earlier was it's a really good outlet of all of that crazy aggression and like moodiness that you have as a teenager.
Right, yeah. I think you should start weightlifting at any age, like whatever age you can. And, you know, the thing for me is, like, I believe that you can never be too strong, and it's never too late to start. And we have people that are just beginning at the age of 14, weightlifting, and we have people that are all the way up to, what, 65?
Almost. I think 63.
Yeah. So, like, we have people, and Masters Nationals is this past weekend, and there's people that are 50 years old putting up, you know, numbers that are new American records for Masters and things like that. And, like, a 50-year-old hit a 146-kilogram clean and jerk.
Yeah, that 50. Was so inspiring to watch, yeah.
Like, so, I mean, the thing is, like, why start younger? And the reason is the sooner you start something, the better you're going to be at it. A longer period of time to train, you recover more quickly when you're young, you're more adaptable, your body is able to acquire those skills and maintain and keep them at a much higher rate when you're younger. So I think that if you start younger, especially with a strength sport like weightlifting, your strength base, like, even if you had to take a break and came back to it, you would probably build up a faster 300-pound back squat if you had already been there before, as opposed to trying to start that, you know, at the age of, what, you know, whatever, 25 or whatever, and you haven't been back squatting.
Yeah, the combination of doing physical training with, you know, just the way that the body develops while you're young is, if you're growing new tissue and growing into your body and kind of, like, doing that in conjunction with, like, a solid training program, like, that's kind of the perfect storm of just setting yourself up to where that's what your body expects, because during your formative years, that's what it was put through. So, like, you're always going to have that good base. And if you can maintain the flexibility you have from childhood and the ability to, like, get into a deep squat, and you train and strengthen those positions, I'm willing to bet anybody that learns to squat well when they're 13 or 14 at 40 is going to be much better at squatting than someone who's trying to learn it for the first time. Just because, like, the neural plasticity is greater in kids. Like, when you're young, the ability to learn a new movement pattern is way, way easier. Because I've even had, you know, like, people have brought their kids in before who are, you know, too young to start, like, training with, like, heavy weights, but can play with the PVC pipe while their parents work out.
Right.
And if you, like, I've noticed that, like, if you just show a five-year-old somebody snatching and give them a stick, they're just going to start mimicking it. You don't have to really, like, yeah. You know, it's they can move through observation, it seems like, a lot more easily than, you know, when I started at, you know, 20 is like, well, I don't know how to move like this. I've never had to do anything like that. And it's a lot, I think it's just a lot more complicated. So being able to make those kind of kinesthetic, like motor learning adjustments at that age is just well above and beyond.
Yeah.
Kids make progress really fast with that stuff.
Yeah. And I think another part of it is, as you get older and you go into jobs or even through college and studying, and or you spend a lot of time sitting at a desk or in a seat, like a chair or whatever. And a lot of the time people, their posture gets like kyphotic. And, you know, if you have a job where you have to be in a cramped space or you're hunched over all the time, I used to maintain and build airplanes, and like, I think that affected a lot of my thoracic mobility. And when I stopped doing it, it improved. And then over time, you know, it's gotten better. But like, when you have less hindrances to your mobility and your, like, where you're putting on muscle when you're younger, like, you haven't developed those bad motor patterns of sitting hunched over. Or maybe you have, like, I've seen a lot of kids like playing on their phone and they're hunched over.
Yeah, but, phone back.
But like, sure. Yeah, phone back is definitely a thing. But I think that when you're younger, you have less of those limitations due to whatever it is that you do for a living, or, you know, your posture from sitting at a desk or a computer. And like, you can reinforce positive motor patterns and positive posture patterns and at a younger age. And then hopefully those will carry on into your later years, and you don't end up that hunched over, like, terrible posture, and that carries over into, you know, whatever sport you're trying to play. Especially weightlifting is something that is affected by it.
Yeah, I mean, it's posture is key, and also just key for not having your back and neck hurt as you get older. You know, if you're strong enough to sit upright in the bottom of a squat with a bar over your head, you're probably going to walk with better posture than somebody who's not doing that. I think there's probably another element to, you know, the importance of, you know, getting kids in the weight room, and that's just kind of general character development stuff, like learning how to kind of take charge of yourself. And like, because everybody's going to have those weightlifting practices where, like, you kind of don't want to do it. Yeah. But, like, you know, like, you have that, like, but getting to a point where you're setting goals and then meeting those and having a lot of success experiences where you're learning that if you set a goal and then you work hard towards it, you'll be able to achieve that weight. Or, you know, you're having these kind of, like, you're ingraining that pattern of that if I work hard at something, I'm going to get a little bit better, and then I'm going to make that progress that I wanted to make. And I think that that kind of work ethic that comes up and kind of comes about through doing, you know, good programmed weightlifting, can carry over to just about anything. You know, it's the same way you get good grades. It's the same way you,
yeah,
you know, you're successful in whatever it is that you're trying to do in your life. If you're getting into the habit of, you know, taking charge of, okay, well, I need to get to sleep early tonight because I have some training. So you're learning to prioritize. You're learning to, you know, set yourself up for success in those things. And then maybe you're failing. So, like, sometimes, you know, we might get to the end of a cycle and it's, you know, like, if somebody, you know, doesn't get the PR that they want, that's a time for learning that lesson. Like, okay, well, what could we do better? Like, what could you be doing? Like, do you make sure to eat enough today? Did you get to sleep early? Are you drinking water? Like, really, like, you know, using those kind of teachable moments to, you know, get people to kind of take control of those other factors that influence, you know, the development.
Yeah, of course. And this kind of goes back to kind of like our mission statement, but I've taken it to heart for sure. And it's our mission is to make people strong in both mind and body using a barbell. And that's what I want to do for whoever walks in the door. And weightlifting is a mentally tough sport and it's a physically tough sport. So I think that when you start young, if you can learn to endure hard things, do things when you don't feel like doing them, or do something that you didn't think that you were capable of doing initially, that's just going to help you later on in life and throughout your career, through your school, and for your own personal benefit and your self-confidence, knowing that, you know, just because something's difficult doesn't mean that you're not able to do it. And I think that a lot of people, you know, they just kind of just go through the motions with a lot of things. And if you're very deliberate about the way you pick up the barbell and the way you use the barbell to train yourself, both mentally and physically, there's a lot that you can get out of it. And I think that if you take your training seriously and you treat it like it matters, that's going to carry over to other things in your life too. And so, like, if you just show up, go through the motions, you're going to get out of it what you put into it. And if you want to be better, you're going to be more deliberate. You're going to be, you know, have a better mindset toward how you're accomplishing your training. And I think that if you can start that as a young age, you'll be able to carry that over into a lot of different other things in your life that will have a positive outcome on.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, from a physical development and a kind of personal development standpoint, there's definitely a lot of benefits to starting at a younger age. And, you know, if you want to be a world champion, that's probably when you need to start anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just in case you want to be a world champion, start young and then figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. You can always, you know, just take it as a hobby later on. But if you want to be good at it, probably start as soon as you can. The younger, the better. Even if you're not actually fully weightlifting, you know, I've seen 6-year-olds snatching, you know, what, 15, 20 kilos?
Something like that.
And
yeah.
It's, that's impressive. Like, that's, you know, a lot of them, that's half their body weight, or, you know, they're starting young. And while you're not pushing their complete physical development yet, but getting used to the idea of just, like, don't be afraid of the barbell. Don't be afraid of trying something new. And that carries over into their lives for sure.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, what do you think about the idea of, like, for youth weightlifting, judging it more on technique? So, like, I've heard a few people make the argument that up until, like, age 16, the competition should be, you know, like, who's performing a bodyweight snatch with the best technique, and create some kind of technique measurements so that you're not tempted to, you know, push 12-year-olds or 13-year-olds to the absolute limit. Because I don't remember who I was listening to the other day. They were talking about developing youth weightlifters, and they were saying that essentially, like, the things that make the best 22-year-old weightlifter aren't the same things that make the best 14-year-old weightlifter.
Right.
So, like, you know, you, like, really using that time that their motor learning is good and they're developing that, this kind of base of work, setting them up for success when they're older, and not, you know, pushing them and trying to, like, set a youth national record at the expense of the rest of their career, you know?
Yeah, I think that there's a cost to, like, trying to push them too far too fast. And that usually is, the cost is burnout, and they end up leaving the sport. And then somebody that could have had even more potential over a longer period of time just got cut short because they were either pushed too hard, or they had too much pressure put on them to perform. And
or they just physically weren't ready to lift those weights.
That's a possibility too. And I think that for, as far as, like, the youth weightlifting standards, as long as the standard's consistent, I think that's the most upsetting thing about like a lot of the rules and things that we have in weightlifting, is that the judging is subjective, because it's all about how the judge sees the lift and whether the lockout was good or not. And it doesn't even have to be technically sound. You could do a complete, you know, garbage catapult lift and still make it and lock it out overhead, and it's fine. It counts. But I think that for the youth, if you had a highly technical lift, how much percentage of their body weight they're lifting, you know, maybe like a gymnastic scoring system, yeah. Right? Where how they have, like, let's say your toes have to be pointed. And that's part of the aesthetic element of it. So maybe for youth lifters, there would be an aesthetic element of like how clean was the lift performed and technically sound, and like give points for that as well as lockout and, you know, the regular stuff. But like you create an additional element to make sure that they're also vying for technically proficient lifts as well as weight, and that they're not pushing just for weight, like, and hurting themselves, or like, you know, like we were saying, they get burnt out, or you're pushing them too far too fast and they're not ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, I heard an interview with, I think it was Matt Bruce, who trained under Gail Hatch from the time he was a kid for like throughout his senior career. And he was saying that when they were starting out, they would like max triples, but that was their max. So like if you couldn't do it three times, you wouldn't lift it.
Oh wow, okay.
And they kind of, he had these systems of, you know, encouraging the kids to like still compete with each other, but they were competing for who had the best triple snatch or triple clean.
Right.
So, you know, finding ways to kind of, you know, make sure that they're staying within the technique range and just getting really good at those lifts until they're at the age where it's appropriate to start ratcheting things up, and until the technique is sound enough. So I think that, you know, figuring out where to like hold in reserve. So like if, you know, you're having, you know, maybe they are doing like a heavy lift for the day, but instead of maybe going up another 5 kilos, doing 2 or 3 where it still looks good, but it's still a heavy weight for them.
Yeah.
You know, so kind of finding those ways to kind of, I don't know, like holding them back isn't quite the right answer, but just like allowing for the progress at what's kind of like the easy next step, and just adding a little bit more challenge and not like just Bulgarian and methoding your 14-year-olds.
Let's call it sustainable progress.
Yeah, that's kind of what you,
because you're not holding them back. You just want to be able to sustain progress, and to do that, you might have to dial it back a little bit on how much they do or how heavy they go and things like that. So yeah, I mean, that's, I agree with that. All right. So hopefully that covers like the youth weightlifting, why you should start younger. Honestly, you should start whenever you can. If you haven't started, start now. We're always, you know, willing to welcome new people in and teach them how to lift. No matter what age you are, if you want to get strong, yeah, you come see us.
So this is the last question we've got. It's kind of tangentially related to what we just talked about, but, you know, so like benefits of Olympic style weightlifting for other sports. So, is it, you know, should other athletes participating in other sports do the Olympic lifts? And this is actually a thing that there's a decent amount of controversy about.
Really?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, you know, collegiate strength and conditioning coaches that do not teach the full lifts. A lot of times people say that all you need of the classic lifts is the power clean.
Okay.
And they might do snatch high pulls, but they won't do the full snatch. And the argument being that if you have 35 freshman football players, can one coach in the hour and 15 minutes needed teach them all to safely and effectively do a full snatch? And is it worth the time investment that it takes to learn for the benefit you get out of it? I'm definitely a believer that you should be I think that the lifts are beneficial for people doing other sports. But I don't think that they're absolutely essential. But I think that if you do have the time and do have somebody that can teach you to do them well, that doing them is going to be good. The reasoning that I have behind that is that doing the snatch high pull, you don't have to be as precise. And yeah, you're getting some power development there, but you're lacking the precision and the mobility aspect. And I think that one of the most beneficial things of doing the full lifts is that you're putting your joints in end ranges of motion and strengthening them at the end range. So you're not doing, because essentially a snatch high pull is a half a lift. You're never getting into the bottom position with the shoulders locked out.
Right.
So I think that building strength through that end range is an important aspect of what weightlifting teaches. Also absorbing force. So if you're doing a full snatch and that bar comes down on top of you, it's not just lifting it up in the air, it's then being able to stabilize it and absorb the impact. And I don't believe that they're as complicated to teach as people think. You know, once you've done it a bunch of times, like, most people, we can get them to power snatch or overhead squat in, like, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have, like, big movement restrictions and you're not, you know, just super, super stiff, it's not that, like, they're hard, for sure, and mastering them is hard. But I don't know if they are as complicated as, how much of, like, people saying, oh, these are super hard to learn, is just them trying to make themselves sound cool.
Yeah.
You know, like, do you feel like they're too complicated for kind of general application?
I don't think so. I think that it's pretty simple to learn. And I've taught people how to clean and jerk in an hour session, no problem. And they'll pick it up and they'll get it. Are they masters at it? No. Obviously not. But do they get the gist of what the lift is about? Yeah, I think so. And it's not, maybe it's because I understand it well enough to explain it to other people in a way that doesn't seem overly complicated. But I think that maybe it's just intimidating to people to learn a new movement that does require a lot of moving parts.
And maybe it's just that it looks dangerous.
Maybe.
Like, people look at a snatch and they're like, that just looks crazy.
It looks crazy when somebody's holding, like, multiple plates over their head and it doesn't look like it's locked out right and their mobility is terrible. That's when it looks like, ooh, maybe they shouldn't be doing that. But if you watch somebody that snatches well, or they have good range of motion and mobility, it doesn't look dangerous at all. It actually looks very beautiful and precise and like, there's an artistic element to it where it's very, you know, it's almost like poetry in motion. Like, to be able to move that fast and then to hold that weight over your head requires a large amount of strength and technique. And so as far as like transitioning to other sports, so here's the thing. Weightlifting is a sport that requires balance, timing, speed, power, and range of motion, right? So if you take any sport, what are the elements of those sports going to have in them? They're going to have some combination of those things. So weightlifting develops not only power, timing, speed, balance, and range of motion, but it also, it's the combination of those things creates a huge amount of bodily awareness. You have to know spatially where the barbell is in accordance with your body all the time. And that's why so many people have a hard time with it, is like getting the spatial awareness and the bodily awareness to know where you're at in space and timing with the barbell. It takes a lot of practice. And so if you can apply that to other sports, let's take golf, for instance. Golf requires precision, balance, timing, speed, range of motion as well. If you take basketball, you know, you still have to have speed. You still have to have balance. You have to have timing because you have to know when to let go of the ball in a jump shot, right? That requires timing, and you have to be able to time it precisely every time to be consistent. For football, you have to be able to be strong and fast, have good balance, spatial awareness, where other players are, where you are in relation to, you know, other players are on the field, and bodily awareness about where the lines are, because if you catch a ball, you don't want to be out of bounds. So like all these things that all these other sports highly value, weightlifting can carry over into. So you might not be a snatch expert, right? But if you're a track athlete and you want to build speed and power, a clean is going to be able to do that, because you have to be able to generate a lot of strength and timing and motion with the leg drive to be able to clean well. And so if you're a track athlete and you're a sprinter and you want to be able to generate a lot of strength and momentum off the starting line, or just continue on that, like timing and balance, all that plays and it's all factors in your athletics. So I think that weightlifting, if that's not your main sport, it still has carryover into a lot of other sports, because a lot of those other sports are looking for things that weightlifting builds.
Yeah, so kind of an interesting anecdote with that is one of our lifters, he's a professional MMA fighter, and he's using the Olympic lifts as kind of, so we're not doing a full snatch, clean, and jerk program, but we're using the snatch and clean and jerk selectively, and especially variants, hang snatch, overhead squat, snatch grip push press, these sort of things. He has kind of told me in the last few weeks, like, okay, so here's kind of what I'm noticing. And it's been that we've been using lighter weights than he was using in the weight room before, but really focusing on going through further ranges of motion and having better technique with them. He's saying that he's feeling the strength carry over more despite not lifting as heavy. Other added benefits for, the martial arts context is that if you're so tight in your ability to kind of externally rotate at the arms or kind of get the elbows up in the front squat, if you're really tight there, it's going to be easier to be submitted via Kimura.
Yeah.
Or, so if you're able to increase the end range of motion of your elbows, your shoulders, your knees, you're kind of getting that flexibility down, it ends up strengthening those joints in positions that might be similar to, like, maybe you have a half an inch further before you have to tap. And that makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and that could make a huge difference, because if the end range of motion for your opponent is, only strong to that certain point, but you're mobile past that point, they're not going to be able to submit you, because that's not going to be a position that you're going to have to tap in. You can just wait till they make a mistake and slip out of it. And then another thing is like hip bridging in jiu-jitsu. If an opponent's on top of you and you're able to hip bridge, 300 pounds, or that timing of being able to explode and push that weight off of you, an opponent's going to have a harder time keeping you down. And they're going to be wary of trying to maintaining a mount position on you, because like you'll be able to hip bridge, grab the arm, and then turn them over and reverse the position on them. So like all these things can carry over. And like for Max, he wants better range of motion, he wants strength in those small stabilizing muscles, because those are going to help him be a better fighter. And they're also building that spatial awareness too. It's like, how close is the bar to the body, how close do I need to keep it, where's my balance at, things like that, things that are just increasing his prior perception as a fighter. And so that's just helping him become a better athlete overall.
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of really good applications. Now, I will say that maybe if you're doing weightlifting as a way to work on other sports, there's probably a point of diminishing returns.
Right.
Like, you don't need to be able to snatch 140 to do well. Like, if you can get up to a bodyweight snatch or just get really good at being able to do comfortable triples with 80 kilos... like, those are the sort of things that are going to, so you don't need to be a specialized full-time Olympic lifter to use the Olympic lifts. Like,
right.
You don't need to make the number one priority driving the snatch up. You can be focused on motor quality. But one of the biggest things that I think is really important in, even if you're not going to use the Olympic lifts, is at least using the Olympic squat. So doing, just parallel squatting, if you think about what you're doing, you're only strengthening partial range of motion within the legs. Even if you go to just below parallel, which is, like legal depth for a powerlifting style squat, there's still about 8 inches of end range of motion in that knee that isn't getting strengthened there. So if you're able to, you're a field athlete, or, you're shooting in jiu-jitsu and stuff, you're getting into that deep knee flexion. If you can't control your knee position at a very deep squat, you're increasing instability in that joint at that end range. So, you know, for athletes, it might be better, you know, to prioritize, like, even if you sacrifice a little bit of weight from what you can do to just below parallel to what you can do rock bottom, strengthening that end range of motion at the bottom and being strong in that closed position of the knee is probably going to lead to better stability if you get into a funky situation elsewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I think that especially the squat, like, that's probably one of the things. So I don't know if you've ever come across maybe like an article or anything similar that says, you know, what three exercises would you choose to do if you only had three for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, one for me would be the squat. The second probably would be maybe a deadlift and then the Turkish get-up.
That's a pretty good answer.
So, like, the three, those would be the three for me. And I think that, you know, if you can squat something, deadlift something, and you can do something with a Turkish get-up, you probably stay in pretty good shape for the rest of your life. And that goes against, like, I love the barbell. The barbell is my apparatus of choice when it comes to fitness and molding myself. But those three movements would probably be the three things that I would carry with me until, like, I couldn't do them anymore.
I mean, the Turkish get-up gets a lot of hate, you know? Like, people, it's like, so common critiques I see of Turkish get-up is like, it doesn't really, you can't move enough weight to build muscle with it. You know, it's overly complicated, it's tiring and annoying, you know, but what I like about the Turkish get-up is that I will agree, the Turkish get-up is not a hypertrophy movement, for general health, like, you know, maintaining your ability to stand up and lay down on the ground is a good thing to be able to do. I mean, like, a lot of times people, you know, if you maintain Turkish get-ups, especially, you know, as a master's, you know, and you're able to do Turkish get-ups with a small weight and you keep doing that, by the time that you're 70, if you trip, you're going to have a better chance of getting up off the floor.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just like kind of a protective mobility thing. Like, I forget what it was, but there was a study that they did where they looked at how many steps it takes somebody to get off the floor. So, like, how many points of contact do you need?
Right.
Like, from laying down on your back, can you sit up and stand up without using your hands? Or how many cans do you need? Or how many steps do you need to take?
Sure.
And then they directly correlated that to mortality risk. So the harder it is for you to get off the floor, you're more likely to die. So, like, I mean, that's, again, you know, correlational right, yeah, research. Correlational, but, like, research. You know, it's an interesting way to think about it. Is your fitness routine improving your ability to stand up?
To function.
Yeah, like, to be able do to, general things.
Yeah. I think that if you could do a Turkish get-up at 80 years old, you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's, no matter what the weight
that's
is.
That's outstanding. Yeah. It's just moving up and down off the floor, you know. Squatting is just getting up and down out of a chair. So, yeah. Like, you know, there's some benefits it's kind, like, of across the board. And, I mean, yeah, we're biased. We're weightlifting coaches.
Yeah.
We view the whole world through this kind of realm, right. You know. But I think that there's definitely some benefits that you get from doing the snatch and the clean. For athletes, I mean, maybe the split jerk isn't as important, but a very good push press is probably really important. Being able to transfer force from legs to arms mm-hmm. and carry that through is, like, it's a lot of sporting movements.
I'd even argue that the split jerk is a carryover because single leg stability and strength is important too. I mean, you don't want to have asymmetries in your muscular development, and that's why a lot of pitchers, like, you only see them throwing with one side, right? Obviously, their dominant hand is the hand that controls the ball and it's got more precise movement, but, like, what do they do for their opposite hand? And that's why a lot of them get that Tommy John surgery, is just because, like, they've that overdevelopment on one side has just created asymmetry and it just wrecks that one limb. So it's just like, what are they doing to balance out that muscular development on one side and then you know, on the other side, like, do you write with your left hand? Do you ever brush your teeth with your left hand? It's like, you basically have one dead side and one side that you're overly using all the time. So I think that weightlifting, although it's very, it's symmetrical and it's takes place in one plane of motion and direction most of the time, like, you build up both sides of the body. Even with the split jerk, you're still maintaining some sort of symmetry. So, like,
do you think that they should alternate
legs? I don't think that you should alternate legs on the split jerk unless it's very light and it's technique work. Like, maybe for, like, split squat type stuff, but, like, I don't think you could split jerk one on one side your whole life and not have an imbalance.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that you do that, because, like, so we were saying that, you know, like, doing the deep squat is definitely, like, if you can only choose one thing and you want to improve sport stuff, just do squats, deep squats.
Yeah.
But I will say that I think that it is important for athletes, and this includes our weightlifting athletes, to get on one leg and do single leg squatting movements, split squats, lunges, step ups, single leg RDLs, those sort of things, because, you know, we do a lot of bilateral things. So, you know, when we say that you should use a well-structured weightlifting program, we mean a program where you do work on not just squatting and clean and jerking.
Yeah.
You know, like, to me, that's what a well-structured program includes, things that are on one leg or one arm or working on that kind of structural balance stuff.
Right.
So, like, you can't neglect those sort of things.
Yeah, so for, like, a pitcher, like a pitcher who's constantly on that one side, maybe having them split jerk on the opposite side, or doing counter, you know, movements that are counter to that one motion, I think would be important. But, like, and so back to the answer to the question, I think that weightlifting carries over into other sports, absolutely. Like a volleyball player, if you want to build your jump, you want to build that height to be able to spike that ball, you got to build that leg strength. You got to build some calisthenics. And you can do that through squats, jumping squats with a barbell. You can do that through, you know, box jumps, and you can do some other, you know, accelerated, you can do like pin squats with a fast acceleration out of the bottom. So it's just like, there's a combination of multiple things that you can do to increase the carryover into other sports. And I think that weightlifting, and we're biased, like I said, like Grayson said, you know, weightlifting coaches, so we want our sport to be carried over into other sports, but it's because we see the value of it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, like other ways of introducing speed work, you know, is like, if you're doing pulls, like, say you're gonna just do clean high pulls because you don't want them to learn the full clean. It's easy to fake a pull, right? So, like, if you're looking for speed development, it's easy to, like, slow down by your third clean pull.
Right.
And maybe you're still getting it up there, but maybe you're not getting that fast speed response. But if you're doing a clean, you have to maintain that acceleration. You have to get the full acceleration or you're not going to get under it. So it's a way to kind of incentivize, you know, like, you know, make sure that you're actually moving the bar fast enough to get underneath it. You're going to get some good speed carryover. And the snatch and the clean and the jerk are all, they're basically plyometric weight exercises. You're jumping and landing and receiving and sticking those weights. And that kind of definitely, you know, moves you into, you know, better speed carryover, better explosiveness. When they assessed, like, vertical jump heights, I think Olympic weightlifters ranked near the highest from, like, the Olympic sports of, like, who can jump the highest.
Yeah.
You know, that makes sense. There's a direct, I mean, and obviously maybe people that can jump really high are just good at weightlifting. Yeah, that's probably a little bit true, but you know, there's definitely improvements in your ability to be explosive and jump. You know, like, I never jumped until I was, like, in my 20s. And okay. I have gotten a lot better at jumping, you know, over the years, you know, right. And, you know, weird little things, like, I can catch stuff better, You know, like I was horrible. Like, I'm still not great at, you know, any sport that involves a ball, but I'm less embarrassed by my ability to catch and throw things than prior.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, it's just, it increases like a lot of that bodily awareness, that ability to hand-eye coordination and some of the other things too. So I think that answers the question, like, yeah, as far as like that goes. So I wanted to bring up something, and it's something that I've been thinking about lately, and it's philosophy related. So somebody said the other day, you know, something about success, and so like if you just try to get better every day, you know, that's how you measure success or whatever. And I was kind of mulling it over, and I think that what does it mean to give your best? Because to me, a definition of success is giving your best in the process, because the process is all we have control over, and giving our best in the process is all we have control over. So like a lot of people get fixed on outcomes. They get fixed on the result. And even if you want to make it weightlifting related, the PR is the result. They're only fixed on making that new PR. They're only fixed on how much more weight did they get on the barbell. But giving your best at that moment is hit or miss. Like, you might make the lift, you might not. It might not be there that day. It might not. Technically, something might be off, or maybe you're a little tight in an area and it's just preventing you from doing whatever it is that you consider your best for that day. But so my question is like, what does giving your best mean? What does that look like to you? Because to me, like, all we really have control over is the amount of effort that we give in the process. We don't have guaranteed results or outcomes and so like if we can say that we gave our best in the process, that's success. But what does that mean to you?
I mean, I think that's a good question. I think that, you know, yeah, we do tend to tie giving your best. We tend to just make an association with that as being successful in whatever you're doing. And that is not always the case, especially if you're pursuing PRs and that sort of thing. So I think that giving your best, probably because it comes down to detail. So if you're coming into the gym, but you didn't drink any water all day, you didn't give it your best.
Right.
So the detail-oriented things. So, you know, being, you know, doing your warm-up the way you know you need to, not the way that you want to because you're tired and it's boring.
Yeah.
Being as committed with 40 kilos as you are with 80. You know, paying attention to how you're feeling and what your positions are and how deliberate you're being with your movements. Like, so doing your best might be like setting yourself up for the potential of, you know, achieving the result that you want. But, you know, doing your best really comes down to, you know, managing as many variables as is feasible for you, right? So, like, right. If you, you know that you need to get better sleep and you're not, then that's not, like, but you're still attacking the workouts really hard, you could be giving a little bit more of your best effort if you're able to, like, dial in on some of those other kind of aspects.
Yeah.
So like, I think that, you know, coming in and being really aggressive with trying to beat your weights, but not focusing on like, but getting so excited about the prospect of going heavier that you neglect how 50 and 60 and 70 kilos went.
Right.
You know, like, so trying to be in maybe controlling variables, you know, like controlling the details.
Okay.
And
that's within the realm of what you can control.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. Like, you have control over how early you go to bed, but maybe not necessarily how quickly you fall asleep. right?
Yeah.
So, but you still try to get there early enough. So, as far as like drinking water, you have control over how much water you might be able to drink during the day. And so you should try to make an effort to do that. But there's some things that are out of your control, and the process, like how you warm up, the weights that you put on the barbell and how proficiently you lift them throughout the entire training session, those are all within your control. So for me, I think that, so I believe that if you treat your training session like it matters, like it's important, then that's giving your best in the process. And it is being detail oriented. It's treating 40 kilos the same as you would treat 100 kilos and moving it just as well. And so like, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of multitasking. I don't think that human beings are actually capable of it. And the reason is because, have you ever tried to snatch and then try to think about multiple things at once? It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Like it's very, it makes it impossible to do anything. If you're thinking about too many things at once, or you're trying to accomplish too many things at once, you have to be focused on a singular task to do it well. And so I think that when you give your best in the process, that means, to me, that means showing up, doing the work as intentional as possible, and then, you know, making effort to do all those things to set yourself up for success within that process as well. And so that's in agreement with what you're saying as far as like all the things leading up to training, but training itself as well.
Yeah, like I think, you know, like you're gonna have bad days. Like I had a bad workout on Saturday, and you know, like it just didn't go the way that I wanted it to. And
well, let's redefine that from bad into something that wasn't optional.
Yeah, like not, it was how you didn't. I wasn't satisfied with my own performance, and I try to be good about this, but I just, like lots of you guys, if something isn't going the way that I want, and it's like I get grumpy about it, like I get upset. But I think that, you know, what I get upset about is when I know that I probably could have done a couple things differently to have made it go better, you know? So like, if it's like, okay, well, I had a bad workout, but instead of just being mad about it, it's like, okay, well, what did I do that didn't set me up for that? And yeah, it's like, okay, well, in the workout, like my hips were really tight and I had just come off of a rest day and I didn't do enough recovery oriented position. Like I basically slacked off on my rest day, and as a result I tightened up and had a negative workout. And it's one of those things that gets really frustrating because you get mad at yourself for, like, you're angry at your body for not doing what you're telling it to. Yeah. Do, and that's kind of a pointless state to be in. But it's still something that I struggle with, you know, where it's, I recognize that sometimes things don't go, even if you do plan for the best.
Yeah.
And that there's always something you could have done a little bit better, but beating yourself up about it just makes the rest of the workout even worse because you're getting angry about it. So
let's reframe the way you look at it too. Then it's like, it's not a bad workout. You had a workout where you didn't hit the things that you ideally wanted to, right? But there's plenty to learn. There's challenges in there that you can embrace, and there's things that you can move forward with that you might not have encountered if you just had a regular workout, a successful workout. But so, like, for if we redefine how you think about good and bad, so like maybe you didn't hit lifts in the positions that you wanted to, but you still worked through it, and you were in a state where you might have been able to have some more mobility beforehand, but you were still able to work through those lifts and still hit lifts and still make, you know, decent lifts. That's success. I mean, I still think that you kind of did give your best in that process at that time.
Yeah.
So that there's no way to fail, Grayson. Like, exactly. If you look at it that way, like, you just did what you could with that specific day and the conditions that you were under.
So I think that, like, part of that is that, you know, it's that reframing. Mm-hmm. So like, if you get caught in a loop where you're just upset about something that, I mean, if for me, all of my issues are always position related. They're always mobility related. Right. So, but understanding that your mobility and your technique are variables. They're going to be different on different days. And giving your best is doing what you can with what you have that day.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, if you reframe it like that, you can kind of start getting yourself out of that spiral. And that's not to say that when you show up and you think that you've done everything right and things still don't go according to plan, it's hard to accept that, like, it's like, okay, well, that was still the best that I could do that day. And it's, I think it just takes practice. Like, you have to, you know, as silly as it is, like, that positive self-talk stuff really helps. Like, you just have, like, being hard on yourself isn't really helpful.
No.
At all.
No, it's not.
Because you're just making yourself upset with yourself. And that's who you hang out with all the time. If you're mad at yourself all the time, you're never comfortable.
Right.
Because you're always at war with yourself. So, yeah, I think that, you know, giving your best, is something that you have to learn, doesn't always mean getting it perfect.
Right. Yeah. And that's all I'm trying to say is, like, and getting people to think about is that, like, you're not always going to be 100%. So, and you don't have control over the results, but what you do have control over is your attitude and the amount of effort that you give in the process. And that's, in anything in life, that's really all we have control over, is like the amount of effort that we give in the process and our attitude towards the things that, you know, happen around us, to us, because of us. And that's an ineffectual, like, you can transfer that over to training. It's just like, do you have control over how much your body tightens up from a previous session? Not really. Can you stretch and do things? Yeah, you can. And when you do those things, that doesn't guarantee success next time. But if you give your best that day, and I'm not saying you can make excuses. This isn't an excuse outlet. It's saying that at this specific point in time, how do you move forward and deal with the exact situation that you're in, whether it's in training, in life, or whatever, and reframe it towards, like, this is a challenge. It might not turn out the way I want it to, but that's okay. I can learn from it. I can move on. I can accept it. And that's part of it as well. So, like, I think that if you have that mindset, if you think about things and, like, I'm giving my best in this moment, in this process right now, it may not be equal to my all-time best, but it's what I have at this moment. And I've watched one of my friends do that recently, not having the greatest circumstances surrounding life, but still giving the best in the process. And it may not be equal to the all-time best that person is able to give, but still showing up and putting in work and doing what they can. And that, I mean, that's, to me, that shows an extreme amount of effort and resilience mentally and physically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that, you know, part of that, you know, can be, say you wanted to do, you know, 110 kilos for your snatch that day, but because of whatever circumstance, you can't quite get up there. Mm-hmm. To me, giving your best for that day would be saying, okay, well, I was supposed to do 3 heavy snatches today, and it's not going to be where I want. But instead of quitting and moving on, finding the weight that you can do that day and doing that, you know, being willing to adjust fire and say, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to get that 170 squat today, but I'm going to make 155 look great, and I'm going to put everything I can into that and accept that that's just where things were at today.
Yeah.
And it's not to, you know, get complacent or try to...
Yeah, it's not excuse making. It's more of just like accepting
the situation as it is.
Right. All right. So I think that covers some weightlifting and some philosophy. I just wanted to bring one thing up real quick, and it's Grayson has been nominated as one of the top 5 best personal trainers of 2019's Alibi Best of Albuquerque. So thanks to everybody that nominated him for this point. So now we need people to actually go out and vote for him to be the number one best of Burke. And so you can do that by going to alibi.com, and the voting ends April 10th. So if you guys could go ahead and hop on alibi.com, vote for Grayson, and get him up some recognition, I would appreciate that. You want to add anything, Grayson?
Yeah, guys, if you could do that, it would be great for our gym and getting the word out about, you know, what we talked about today, using the Olympic lifts to make yourself a little bit better in that process and keeping up with all things weightlifting. We'll be back next week. And yeah, guys, give a rating on iTunes. We're on Stitcher now. So yeah, we're on welcome Stitcher. Stitcher listeners.
Yep.
And yeah, we'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, y'all. Until next time, happy lifting.